I'm in and out of Pete Gotti's house every single day of the week. So Pete Gotti, I'm close with Pete's son, Pete. So there's a John Gotti had a son, Peter, and then Pete Gotti, John's oldest brother, who was a captain, eventually the boss, he had a son, Peter. So I'm in and out of his house every day. So they got my phone records going back and forth to Pete's house every single day of the week. So they're going, okay. And, you know, obviously I see Pete there, right, all the time. So, okay, maybe he could give us to Pete Gotti. Even if he gives us the kid, it's news headlines, right? So we got that.
Welcome to the Cops and Writers Podcast. On this show, you will learn how to write the best crime-related novel or screenplay possible. Your host, Sergeant Patrick O'Donnell, worked the streets in one of the nation's largest police departments for over 25 years. Ride along with O'Donnell and his expert guests as they help you navigate the oftentimes confusing and misunderstood world of law enforcement. O'Donnell and his guests on this show do not represent any law enforcement agency. The content of this show is not meant to be legal advice. You think you need a lawyer? You probably do.
Hey, Cops and Writers. Thanks for being here with us today for another episode of the Cops and Writers Podcast. I'm Patrick O'Donnell, and I will be your host for today's show. This show is listener-supported, so thank you to all of you who keep the show going. I would especially like to thank those of you who are patrons of the show. Most notably, Francis Sheldrick, Kathleen Donnelly, Fran Cross, Catherine Kovacic, Richard Tolles, Ryan Ta, Melinda Colt, and Carl Vondero. Your generosity helps pay for the software, equipment, and my time producing this show. Yes, you too can become a patron for less than a cup of coffee or a pint of Guinness. Just go over to patreon.com/copsandwriters. I would also like to thank all of you who have purchased my books in the Cops and Writers series, available on Amazon. Welcome to part one of my interview with former member of the Gambino crime family, now international best-selling author, television producer, and director, Louis Ferrante. Mr. Ferrante grew up in New York City and became entangled in the Gambino crime family. He was eventually arrested and served almost 10 years in prison. While he was incarcerated, he taught himself to write, and he fell in love with books. He promised himself that he would someday become an international best-selling author, and he did. Lou also created, wrote, produced, and hosted Inside the Gangster's Code series for the Discovery Channel about maximum security prisons and gang culture around the world. As a special treat to everyone, I'm bringing back my friend and colleague, podcaster, author, and retired NYPD detective Vic Ferrari. Vic spent most of his life in New York City and was assigned to the NYPD's Organized Crime Unit and specialized in stolen cars, the same area of criminal expertise that was Lou's, just on the other side of the law. Please enjoy this powerful and inspirational conversation with Lou Ferrante and Vic Ferrari. Lou Ferrante, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Pat, for having me.
And, of course, returning champion, my celebrity guest co-host, Vic Ferrari.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Of course.
Nice to meet you, Vic.
You too, Lou.
So, Lou, I caught you on the interview on the Art of Manliness podcast, which is one of my favorites, I got to say. And it instantly grabbed me, and I'm like, I got to have this guy on my show. This is such an interesting story. Man, there's so many layers. You're like an onion, Lou. There's a whole lot of layers to you. So,
with a little garlic.
Yeah, and I'm a little potato because, you know, I'm the Irish guy here. So let's start out with, why do you think we're so fascinated with criminals, more specifically like gangsters?
I wondered, when I was doing my research, I came across a lot of fascination with criminals that dates back to the 1800s.
Wow.
I mean, you know, the Jesse James gang, people were fascinated with, you know, all the way up through the bank robbers of the 20s and 30s after, you know, during the Depression, Dillinger, you know, Pretty Boy Floyd, et cetera. And I think that Americans, they like sort of like, they know we live in a corrupt system. Everybody's content with that to some degree. Okay, we get it. All of the people above us who preach all this morality are usually crooked. And we like when the guy who just waves the finger and says, I am crooked. I'm not hiding it. I'm, you know, refreshingly free of false modesty. Here I am. This is what I do. And I feel like that sort of, and I found even a quote from Oscar Wilde, the British writer, who said, Americans love their criminals and they worship them. And then in the age of the, you know, in the age of mafia, sort of like when the mafia became sexy, all these movies, you know, starting out with like, well, maybe a little with Edward G. Robinson, those type of movies, but really like when they started with the Godfather trilogy and Goodfellas, people started to see Goodfellas wasn't that obviously that romantic, but the Godfather trilogy was, you know, I think it gave the mob like a name that they didn't deserve, where it looked really like fascinating and it was all about all of this honor and stuff. And, you know, there's a little of that involved, but for the most part, that was a bunch of hogwash.
Yeah, you know, I was just, before I hit record, I was talking to a friend of mine that's a romance writer, and we're just, and she just got her citizenship for Italy. And, you know, she's from Sicily, her family is. And I said, you know, and she said that, you know, mob romance right now is red hot. That's really? Like a huge genre right now. And like, Cecilia, yes, I'm talking about you. She's, and she, you know, she's got her finger on the pulse, and I'm like, okay, before, you know, it was vampires and, you know, like billionaire romance. And now, you know, mob romance is like picking up steam.
Every woman I ever dated was a mob romance. I mean, I should be able to write that easy.
You should. You should. Yeah. You know, I, my mind goes to like The Sopranos, Scarface, Sons of Anarchy. You know, they were huge successes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what I liked about Sons of Anarchy, even though, you know, I talked to an undercover ATF agent that was in the Mongols, and he's like, yeah, we used to call it the Sons of Malarkey. You know, it's a bunch of BS.
Yeah.
But
if you're a biker, you know the ins and outs. If you're a biker, if you're not a biker, you buy it.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. But the thing about it was, what I liked at the very end is, like, you know, the main character, Jack Stellar, is like, we're not good people. We do really bad stuff. And, you know, he didn't want his kids thinking it was cool or wanted to glorify it or whatever. He says, yeah, we suck. We're bad people. We do a lot of illegal stuff and we hurt a lot of people. So, but you know what? Scarface, Sopranos, like I said, you know, they're huge. So for you, how do you keep these stories of the mob, you know, in the old days, fresh for today's audience? You know, you're a writer, you've written a bunch of books, you know, and you're, I would say, a very good historian as well of all of this. You know, how do you keep it fresh for today's audience?
What I did in the Borgata trilogy, volume one is out now. What I did there was I was able to debunk a lot of myths. And I remember when I was in prison, I never wanted to look at the mob again. You know, I knew I was suffering for all the crap that I had done. And so I avoided books about true crime. I stuck to history, biographies, once I became an avid reader. And the guys used to go to the television room once a week to watch The Sopranos, and they go, Louis, come in. It's on. The Sopranos is starting. I said, what are you watching that crap for? I go, this is what got us here. You know, you want to watch, what do you want to torture yourself? That's why we're here. So I never watched it. And then it ended up that when I came home from prison, I wrote a memoir, and Lorraine Bracco bought the rights to that memoir. She optioned it for a year. Oh, wow. And I said, son of a bitch, I never watched The Sopranos. I got to go back and watch it. And I got to tell you, I did get hooked. It wasn't bad. I thought it was done really well. So that said, I did remember, though, a lot of the guys who were in jail reading mob books, and a lot of guys, bosses, underbosses, capos, you'd hear a lot of them blurting out, bullshit, never happened, give me a break. So when I started doing my research, I realized that, you know, if you live this life, like the guys you said who were bikers, and they realized that the Sons of Anarchy really wasn't accurate, whereas the rest of us, we don't know any better. We watch it. We've never been a biker. I've never been in the Hell's Angels. What the hell do I know? I knew Hell's Angels, but I never been with the club. So I don't know any better. So the same thing when you're a mob guy, you know, if you're reading something that's true, that could have happened or it never did. So when I started reading all the history, I realized that, wow, there's a lot of things where a bell would go off in my head and I'd say, this never happened, whether it was about Frank Costello, Albert Anastasia, Lucky Luciano. And I would then try to trace back where this story may have originated. And I would find usually the original source. And then usually the case was that subsequent historians then would just quote the original source and repeat the story. And through time, it would become sort of like a time verified truth where it wasn't true. And then what I did, instead of telling the reader, this is bullshit, you should believe me because I lived a life, I would say to the reader, this is why this could never have happened. And I would explain it. So I debunked a lot of myths where the goal is to get the reader, by the time they finish volume one of the Borgata trilogy, to think like I think and to know and smell it when something's off. You could sniff it out. And that's sort of like where I want the reader to come along with me on that journey. And I explain time and again, but I don't bog the reader down in sort of lessons. And you know, I'm not pontificating. It's gory stories. I get in deep into the intrigues. I keep the book moving. Lots of blood and guts. But I do now and then veer off to explain something if it could never have happened that way. And I think that's what I brought new to the table. So it's sort of like reinventing the stories that you've heard all these years, but which ones are true, which ones could never have happened, and if it didn't happen, what might have happened, what probably happened. And so far, I've had tremendously positive feedback in the way of people liking that. They've really felt like that was sort of like really something new I brought to the table.
Right. You know, thinking about, you know, the mob and street gangs of today, you know, where I worked in Milwaukee, it was split up by ethnicity. You know, it's like, okay, the black gangs were black gangster disciples, vice lords. Mm-hmm. The Hispanic gangs were Latin kings and Latin queens, Mexican posse, Spanish Cobra, MS-13, Brown Pride, La Familia. And then for the whites, it was outlaw biker gangs. You know, there was the outlaws, you know, they're worldwide. And what we call it was their bitch club was the Black Pistons. You know, that was kind of like their associate club. They were like a tier down. And a lot of guys would have to spend some time in that club before they could bump up to the outlaws. And then I was introduced to the Asian Crips, ACs. I didn't even know they existed until I went to a beatdown with baseball bats. And one guy had an AC tattoo. And I'm like, Asian Crips, he said, and he like smiles at me and he's got like a tooth missing. He's bleeding and shit. He's like, no, American citizen. And I'm like, oh, okay. That's what that means. And I'm like, yeah, my ass. Nice try. So what parallels, you know, are there between the mob and like street gangs? Like I just done.
Well, we got along with everybody. I did know guys from all the different gangs you said. I knew the leaders of these gangs. I was away with some of them. Some of them I knew on the street. And we got along with everybody. I was away with when you talk about white gangs, usually it's their motorcycle clubs, but I was also away. There were guys, when I got my very first day in the population at Lewisburg Penitentiary in Pennsylvania, day one, and your listeners could look up the story. I land in that pen. And the first day, the Aryan Brotherhood hacked to death two black Muslims. Aryan Brotherhood were rough. I mean, they had prison-made machetes. There was a metal shop there where they made lockers, they made bunks, and they made machetes. And you could be walking in the yard any given day, and you'd see like a barred window. There was a particular place where they used to throw them. They tossed them out into the yard, and then guys would either try to sneak them in from the yard or bury them out in the yard. These machetes wrapped up. In something like a cloth or something with string or rope. But anyway, the Aryan Brotherhood, I was with Jimmy Coonan, boss of the Westies. When I landed there, he greeted me, took me out into the yard. He had introduced me to the head of the Latin Kings, head of the different gangs. And then they called lock in. We went in, and no sooner did I get back in the block, I met the head of the Aryan Brotherhood that day in the yard. And he was as calm as me, you, and Vic are right now on this podcast. There wasn't any inclination that he was about to do something this horrendous. You would never have known. If I gave you $1 million to guess what this guy was going to do, you would have probably bet $1 million that he was going to go in, crash on his bunk, and go to bed for the night. And that was it. And he went in, stripped down to his boxer shorts, passed out homemade machetes to his gang, and they had a hit list. And after they whacked two guys, they were actually trying to get three or four more that they had on the list. But by then, the guard pulled the pin, you know, hit the panic button. And the alarms were going off all over the prison. And then they just said, basically, you know, they went off script and said, stab every end that you can. And they were just trying to stab any African-American that they could get their hands on. But they had already bludgeoned two to death. So that was the Aryan Brotherhood. That was my first real introduction to the real Aryan Brotherhood. You know, it was my first day in the penitentiary. Sure, I met guys before in holdovers in the detention center in the state, in the county, that claimed to be either Dirty White Boys or Aryan Brotherhood. But I don't think that they were to this level where these guys were all serving life and didn't care if they ever left or not. You know, I mean, they just, you know, I mean, it was a different level of barbarism.
So for you, you were connected to, you know, the mafia. So were you just in that subculture and people kind of kept their hands off you?
Yeah, well, yes and no. I mean, there's an element of people know us, so we get along with everybody. We have obviously alliances with everybody, blacks, Asian, white, doesn't matter. You know, Italians know how to operate. Plus, we're one of the only groups that go into prison with a few dollars. So, we, you know, if we want to flex our muscles, we could, you know, we could buy one gang off against another if we had to. You know, I mean, we know what we're doing. But, you know, it's more like we get along with everybody, but you're still on your own. I mean, John Gotti got cracked in the face. You know, he had a black eye that came out online. That's John Gotti. You know, somebody said to him, listen, I don't give a shit. You ain't sending your dark Lincoln Continentals with violin cases in here. It's me and you, buddy. You know, and that's like the pen. You know, you're dealing with life. Is when I was in the pen, I had 13 years. I faced life, but I had a 13-year sentence. I copped out, me and my co-defendants. Everybody stood up. And when I got there, everybody told me, don't tell anybody you're doing 13 years. And I said, why? That's a lot of time. And they said, not to these guys. Most of these guys got that in or double that already, and they're never leaving. They'll be jealous of you. And I remember the day I was leaving Lewisburg, a year and a half later, when I finally got dropped down to a medium security, the hack came to my cell and says, you want to get locked in for the night? And I said, no, why? And he said, well, a lot of times guys are jealous if somebody's leaving, and I've seen people get killed the night before they leave. I go, no, I'm all right. I ain't checking in. I'm fine. And but that gives you an idea of you're in the pen. People don't care. You know, if a guy's got six life sentences and he thinks you stole his apple out of his locker, What is he going to get if he kills you? Seventh life sentence? You only got one life to live. So these guys are dangerous. So it really doesn't matter. You got to handle yourself. You have to know how to handle yourself. It doesn't matter where you come from. However, there are alliances, and you do get along with people automatically because of that. You know, when I was there, people knew I came from the Gambino crime family. People knew I was friendly with I'm still close friends with Vicarina to this day, 35 years later. Vicarina Sr. was the boss of the Colombo family. Vicarina Jr. was a captain in the Colombo family. My dear, dear, dear friends. So I get along with everybody. I mean, they knew where I came from. And so that's sort of like wherever I landed, if any one of the five families was there, they would automatically take me around, introduce me to the other gang leaders and say, this is Louis. He's friends with us. And then I was automatic friends with them. But that doesn't stop some knucklehead, like I said, who's doing life from trying you. Then you're on your own. You know, at that moment, you're on your own. And I was ready for that too. You know, at times I had to do what I had to do. You know, I mean, that's just life. That's, you know, that's what sucks about that place though, because once I had a faith in God, I had a renewed faith in God. I lost faith in God when I was younger. My mother died in my arms. But when I renewed my faith in God, I would say a prayer that not only, you know, protect my own life, but I really don't want to kill nobody else. Protect me from killing somebody else, because I'd like to get out of here without being involved in a murder, whether it's my own or somebody else's. And yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil. I mean, that kept me going. So, and I, by the grace of God, I got out without having to kill anybody and without nobody taking my life.
We'll be right back.
Today's episode is sponsored by the thrilling audiobook Avenging Adam, book one in the FBI canine thriller series written by author Jody Burnett. Sparks fly between hotshot FBI agent Rick Sanchez and no-nonsense FBI canine handler Kendra Dean as they chase a ruthless serial killer. Witness an electrifying blend of suspense, romance, and redemption, where internal conflicts challenge our heroes as much as their target does. Will they catch the killer before it's too late? Grab Avenging Adam now. It's more than a story. It's an experience. Get 50% off the Avenging Adam audiobook at jody-burnett.com/copsandwriters.
Lou, let me ask you. I always wanted to ask a guy this. So you were in a high level of maximum security, right? At what point does someone keep committing violence in prison that they say, all right, you know what? Enough is enough. And they wind up at like Supermax in Florence. You know what I mean? Yeah. Because obviously they can't really hold much over your head if you're in a max.
Yeah.
But I mean, to go out to Colorado in that Supermax prison, I mean, how much is that a threat to guys? Like, do I really want to increase
it's a great
what I'm
question.
Doing?
Yeah. Great question, Vic. And nobody really ever asked that question. I've never heard it before. And it's a great question because it gets into psychology. And there are people in jail who, even if they're doing life, they'd rather have an easier ride. They'd rather be able to go to the chow hole during the day, walk the yard, you know, until lock in, play bocce, play handball, play basketball. There are guys that you could hold, you could hold dessert over their head. You're not going to get dessert tonight if you F up. And it's true. You know, I don't want to lose my chocolate cake, even though I'm doing life. I like my chocolate cake. So there are guys that these rewards and punishments affect them. Then there are guys who I believe, and I've seen quite a few of these guys, and it's staggering. And I had to think about where the hell, what's wrong with these guys? They are almost like self-abusive, like
masochistic.
Yeah. And you would see these guys get into a beef. They'd start a beef, let's say, where they know the goon squad is going to come and beat their brains in. And they do it time and again. They get out. They do it again. They get out. They do it again. Then they're in the hole. And you'd be in the hole with a guy. And the guy's flushing, you know, clogging the toilet and flooding his cell. And you're saying to the guy, hey, buddy, you know they're going to come in there. You might have 6 inches or a foot of water in there. You might think you did something, but they're going to beat your brains in, brother. Yep. Stop. Unclog the bowl and let it go down. F you. This guy knows what they're going to do. He must want the beating. You know, you got to say this guy's like inviting it. So those characters who are masochistic, those guys just continue to ask for it until it's, and even they start beefs with people where they know they're going to get hurt. You see that too. You know, a guy will take on four guys, you know, let's say a white guy or a black guy goes to the opposite race and tells them all to go F themselves. You know what's going to happen. You know, I mean, you don't have to be a brain scientist to figure this one out. I saw a guy one time walk into the television room. You got 30 guys glued to the TV, whatever the frig was on that day. And the guy changes the channel. You don't know that 30 people are going to beat your ass right now? Of course you know. He was taken out in a stretcher. So these people are the ones who eventually then, you know, the system, you know, eventually just gets them out and says, look, you're a problem. You're going to the Supermax or you're, you know, after, and they might spend 6 months, a year in the hole before that decision is made. But then eventually they know that they're just a disciplinary problem. But for the most part, going back, so it's a psychology question, which I don't hear a lot of. So it's a great question, but going back to the 99% of guys in there, including myself, are sensitive to rewards and punishments. We don't want to lose the chocolate cake. We don't want to use our privileges. We don't want to lose the trip to the yard. We don't want to be locked down. We don't want to go to the hole. You go if you have to. You lose the cake if you have to, but it's got to be something that's worth it, you know, for the most part. So that works for most people. But those people who are sadistic or masochistic, they just can't help themselves.
I think you're right. I think it goes back to our childhood. Right. Like your mother or your father. I mean, they're not going to take the belt to you every 15 minutes. But like you just said, well, you know what? When we were kids, you're not watching The Wonderful World of Disney or you're not getting a piece of chocolate cake. And that was a big deal to us.
Yeah. Yep. You know, it's funny because Vic and I talked to a guy. His name is Matt Cox. He was in a medium security. And then, you know, he dropped down to minimum after X amount of time. And he said a lot of the beatdowns were deserved. He said, you know, they're cheating at cards. They owed, you know, like somebody for commissary or whatever. And it's like, well, what do you think is going to happen to you? Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't go without consequence.
Yeah. I'll tell you a story. You're right. There was guys look for trouble. And you're right about that. And there was one instance I was in a detention center. I came back on appeal and I was in a detention center where there was a technicality that I was able to win an appeal on, not because I was innocent, obviously, but I came back on appeal. And I'm in a detention center and there was a kid I heard screaming and I went back there and there was a lot of guys around. I'm not going to say what type of guys or whatever. So nobody gets offended because it happens with every type of guys. There was a group of guys around them and I said, oh, back off, leave them alone. And they did. They backed off. The kid had a laundry net bag over his head and it's sort of like half tied up already. So they were abusing the kid. And I thought that something sexual was going to happen to him. So I stepped and I took a shot. You know, I mean, it's my own ass on the line once I step out for this kid. And the next time I heard screaming, I went back there again. And I said, what the F's going on? And that's when the leader of that group grabbed me. And he said, hey, Lou, he looks for us. And I said, what? He looks for us. So he wanted that. So he liked being abused / sexually abused by a group of men. This was his thing. So, you know, and then I said, son of a bitch, here I am reaching out.
Yeah,
you know, I could get stabbed. I could get cut. My throat could get cut. Here I am reaching out to help somebody. And he wanted it. He was looking for them. And, you know, when he said that, I looked at everybody else, including the kid. And the kid's face was like, you know, kind of a shrug, like, well, you got me. You know, yeah, you blew my cover. I was out here having fun, son of a bitch. You ruined it twice for me now. You know, so whatever the case is, you don't know. You know, you got a lot of psychological issues in there. And I got to tell you, though, it's a cross-section of society. We just don't know when we're out, when we're online at Costco, when we're online at Walmart. You don't know who's behind in front of you.
You're right.
When I lived in that place, when I lived in that place, I saw a lot where when I'm online now, I know somebody's, you know, somebody in this store's nuts. I don't know how many, somebody's off. You know, and you just know it's a different cross. It's a cross section of society, and you're seeing all of their human frailties out in the open, whereas normally you don't see it out in the open in public. You know, you don't, you know, until the neighbor gets raided by the police. You know, you don't know.
You're right. You're absolutely right. So, what is the attraction to being in like a gang, the mafia? Is it family? You know, like belonging to something? What do you think?
I loved it. I thought I liked the sense of bonding. I loved my friends. I thought that we had something special with each other. I don't like though the mafia, the bigger part of the mafia is when you got a little crew of friends you grew up with and you love them. Then you get involved with the mafia and you think you're bonding and you think you guys are just part of something bigger. But then at some point I realized that the mob could tell you to kill your friend and you got to do it. And, you know, I'm not killing a friend. So, you know, puts you in a jam. So that's sort of like, you know, it's not all roses. It's not what you think. It's like everything else, right? Until you're part of it, people work so hard to become a partner in a law firm, then they're partners and they realize there's all kinds of headaches that goes along with it or something. You know, I remember I read an article in one of the newspapers where people more and more turn down partnerships in law firms for whatever reasons. You know, they don't want to be bothered with all the headaches that come with it. And it's the same thing with the mob. It's the same thing with everything. If we watch, look at Vic, right? We watch police shows all day long. It's the sexiest, romantic, toughest, courageous, biggest thing. Vic will tell you a different side of it. He'll go, you don't know what it's like. You know, first of all, the paperwork that's involved. Maybe he's got to walk in and see domestic abuse. Maybe he's got to walk in and see a head in a refrigerator. I don't know all the things you've seen in your career over there. You know, you might say it's not as romantic as they portray on TV. You know, and you guys turn on the TV and turn it off, but live that. Walk in and smell a corpse, and then tell me that's romantic and sexy. We're not smelling it in our living room. You know, it's not smell-o-vision. So it's a little different.
Lou, you were a big time earner. So I'm guessing, I mean, I've followed your career. I've watched you on interviews and I know you were a big time earner. So obviously you got a lot of attention from a lot of the families because someone wants to latch onto you because now you're going to kick up. Mm-hmm. And you said that you were associate of the Gambinos. How long were you an associate for with them?
Well, you know, I from when I hijacked my first trucks in my late teens to when I went away at 25, I was around guys from a few different families, but for the most part, the Gambino family. So it was, you know, the better part of 6 years, I'd say 7 years, I was in and out of people's houses, the biggest guys in the family. So I was there until the day I went to jail. And then when I went to jail, by the way, until I came home, I'm around those same guys, but in jail. You know, we just reunite in prison. Yeah, I
mean, at some point, someone's going to tap you on the shoulder, and go, "Lou, we want to propose you." Was that something you were looking forward to, or was that something like no?
No, at that time I was ignorant and I desperately wanted it. I did. I wanted it before I went away. A friend of my dearest friend, I've mentioned his name on other interviews. I'm going to hold back from mentioning it today. Sure. But one of my dearest friends, got straightened out right after I went away. And, you know, I was proud and happy for him. He probably would have brought me next. And then when I went home years later, he did ask me, you know, he says, "You want me to put you up?" I says, "I'm a different person. Forget it. It's done." And he said, "I thought so," but they kind of like my friends, when I was away, I'd be telling them I'm done with this, but everybody says that and they all go back. So, you know, really nobody believed me until they saw me and saw me like living a different life. And then they believed me. And this particular friend, to his credit, he was a great guy. A lot of friends realized when I was done, what good is he? What use is he? And I lost a lot of them. You know, they didn't need me anymore because I'm not involved in that life. And they are, and they believe in that life. But this particular friend was still there for me as a friend. not as a mob guy. He wished me the best. He says, anything you have a need for me, I'm here for you. And he was an incredible guy. I mean, he was just so, but for the most part, a lot of guys are like, he's done. Who needs him now? And a lot of guys don't go straight. You know, they talk about it. And I remember one guy thought that I was playing it off, like just to come home, like, sure. You know, playing it off, to, like trick the feds that I'm, you know, like one time a guy says, like, you're doing the chin gigante, like, you know, you're fooling everybody. And I said, I'm not fooling anybody. It's real. I'm done. So, you know, so that's sort of like, you know, a different reaction I had from one particular guy.
You know, I'm going to go back to the head in the refrigerator. I was a cop in Milwaukee for 25 years. And I knew the guy who found the head in the refrigerator, Dahmer's apartment. Holy cow. That will change you really quick. You know, that had so many ripple effects. I mean, one of the DAs in the case wound up being a Jesuit priest. He quit the DA's office and became a priest. He was so like morally offended by everything that he saw and it was involved in. He's like, how can a human do this to another human?
So there you go, Pat. That's a perfect example. You know, you saw 25 years of different levels of that, I'm sure.
So is Vic. You know, it's just, it will either push you towards God or push you away from God. That's the way I saw it. I saw a lot of like born again Christians. And then I saw like extreme atheists, because you'd go to a scene and it's like, well, there can't be a God if I'm seeing what I'm seeing. And then you go to another scene and it's like, how is this person alive? There must be a God.
Yeah.
So, you know, it goes both ways. Yeah. So let's talk, you know, Mafia today. Are they still in operation, you think?
I think to a degenerative degree. They've definitely lost a lot of the bigger rackets that they had. I was close. I got close in jail for the most part with Sal Avellino. He controlled all of the garbage on Long Island. They don't have that anymore. You know, now it's a big corporation that controls all the garbage. Or I should say he was charged with controlling the garbage. They had the garment center, all of the trucking industry in and out of the garment center. People probably still have bits and pieces of that still. But for the most part, most of the unions that they held have been infiltrated by the government. And the government then gives people a lot of opportunity. A lot of guys get opportunities to like, okay, you have to leave the union. If you contest it, then we're gonna prosecute and prove that you're somebody. If you don't contest it and you get the hell out, we're going to leave you alone. And a lot of guys took that decision and said, I'm out. You know, I'm good. Whether it be whichever union it was, there's quite a few of them. I remember when I came home, a couple of guys approached me for legal counsel. They knew I reversed one of my cases from prison, and I had helped other people reverse their cases from prison. So a lot of guys asked me legal questions. Sure. And 100% of the guys that were given that letter and asked me for their advice, I told, get the hell out. You know, just to give you an idea, I said, get out. They're giving you a chance. Don't test them. You know, a lot of the unions are lost. You know, they might still have a little loan sharking. They might still have gambling. You know, they got sort of like the rackets that they probably should have stuck with from the beginning. But a lot of the bigger rackets, I think it's gone. Hijacking. Look, I used to hijack trucks left and right. You hijack a truck today, where are you going with it? There must be 500 tracking devices on this thing. They're following you on an Elon Musk satellite.
You're absolutely right.
And I'm going to have the two of you guys. So you on one runner and Vic on the other. Go and get out in 3 seconds. Do I need that? So, you know, think about even the Spark Steakhouse hit. How many people would film that today on their iPhones? Right? Yeah. I mean, come on. We'd see all the Russian hats and the Cossack hats, and they're moving in on Castellano, and everybody's got their iPhones out. So, you know, it's a different world. I don't know what you could get away with now. They could hear you through your cell phone. You can't even carry a cell phone anywhere. If you want to talk, they push a button. They can hear you through your cell phone. Yeah, I don't know what you're going to get away with really now. So I think they've lost a lot of the power that they had. And I think also too, it's not as attractive as it once was to young, stupid kids like me. Okay, I think a lot of kids realize there's bigger opportunities out there.
Yeah. So you were born in New York City. What part of New York did you grow up in?
Queens, New York, my whole life till the feds took me away and shipped me around the country. Queens, New York.
Okay, so Queens, New York. How did a kid from Queens wind up being a hijacker?
You know, it's a good question. There's a few things that go into that. And it's psychology. So I think thinking back again throughout my life, there must be something in people's blood, because A lot of times I know cops whose father was a cop, grandfather was a cop. It's in your blood. You're led that way. Or maybe you have, you from when you're young, that's something you want to do. You want to be somebody who goes out there and courageously defends somebody. And then, obviously it gets involved with a lot of other stuff and there's just few courageous moments in there, but that's what draws you to it. And that's, you want that. So there's different reasons why we're drawn to things, but there's an element of it is in our blood. And I'll tell you right now, my mother's family, my uncle was a hijacker. I could remember going to visit him in Sing Sing, where my feet didn't even touch the floor in the visiting room. So here I am going to visit my uncle in Sing Sing, who was a hijacker. And then years later, when I got transferred from the feds to the state, I'm pulling in on the bus. I'm shackled hand and foot. I got a black box around my wrists. It just endured this long ride up to Sing Sing. I'm chained to the guy next to me on top of the black box, on top of the shackles. And I pull up and I said, son of a bitch, I haven't been here since I was a kid. And, what went wrong in my bloodstream? What can't we shake out of ourselves that's in us? My father's family were law-abiding people. My mother's family, like I said, it was a little different. So that's part of it is that you got something inside you maybe in your bloodstream that's a little different. And then the other thing, too, is I think it's sort of like nature and nurture. You know the argument. A little bit is who you are. A little bit is sure. How you're raised. A little bit is your environment. There's a lot of different issues. Behavioralism, psychologists have gone deep down that road and to try to figure out what makes the criminal mind. But I think it's also too a bit of that. I wouldn't have been in the mob if I grew up in Boondock, Nebraska or something. But
sure.
I probably would have been rustling cattle or something. I don't know, stealing corn. I don't know what I would have been doing. Moonshine.
Do you think it's like your friend group? Friends when you're growing up have such a huge influence on you, more than your parents, more than your church, your little buddies are like everything.
Yes. And part of it though, is you gravitate towards the group of friends that you're comfortable with.
Sure.
So, I played JV football and I loved it. And I loved the guys I played football with. Then I made the varsity team and I quit because I was already chopping cars and I was running in high school. So I moved away from those guys and I ended up hanging out with guys who were car thieves and guys who were involved in that business. And did I like looking back? I loved each group equally, but I think I was more drawn at that time in my life towards the group of thieves, the wild group. And I wish I would have stayed with the football group. These guys are probably the guys I would have more in common with today. But during that period of my life when I was wild and I wanted to do wild things and I wanted to make money and I wanted to go out there and do crazy stuff, I was drawn to that other group of friends. So you gravitate towards people who are a reflection of who you are. And I think we always do that. I think that's sort of like, show me your friends, I'll show you.
So you started stealing cars and chopping them up. For those who don't understand what chopping means, could you kind of explain, how did you pick a car? How did you steal it? What did you do with it after you're done with it?
Originally, we would just do joyrides. And there was no profit involved. We'd do donuts and ditch the car. The most we got was like the change in the console. Go buy a slice of pizza. We're young kids. Everybody always had change in the console. You grab the change, you go buy a slice of pizza, and that's it. Maybe yank the radio out. Back then they used to have the radio, then they did the Benzie boxes. I don't know if guys our age will remember that. Kids nowadays won't know what the frig a Benzie box is, but it was sort of like, it was a defense against people like me, the Benzie box, which was you slip your radio in and it connects. And then when you get out of your car, you slip your radio out of the sleeve.
Yeah, you take it out. Yeah.
You take it with you. Yeah. You put it under the seat and you take it with you. And, eventually we started selling those parts and there were body shops. Vic will remember this probably, if you don't, Pat, there were body shops on College Point Boulevard in College Point. Then eventually we dealt with this big shop. He started on College Point Boulevard and he eventually got this huge place that had, it was from one end of a block to another and had entrances on both sides of the block. And it was down by the Kosciuszko Bridge, either like Maurice Avenue, somewhere down there. I think it was Maurice Avenue, or I took Maurice Avenue to get there through one of the entrances. And we were chopping cars, bringing in parts around the clock. And in the beginning, we would ditch the car. We would get an order for parts. So just so your listeners understand, a body shop gets your car. You get into a collision. And the body shop gets the car. And now the car's, let's say, if it's not totaled out, let's say it's got like $18,000 worth of damage today. Maybe back then it was like $8,000 worth of damage. And for that $8,000 worth of damage, the body shop has to go to either direct to Ford or Chrysler or aftermarket parts they would buy. If they didn't go direct to the dealership, they'd buy aftermarket parts, or they would have to deal with parts and get them from a junkyard. But either way, it was cheaper to buy the parts from us stolen. You know, if we and so we would then, you know, if $8,000 out of that $8,000, you got to, three is only labeled, but you got to spend $5,000 in parts, and you could buy the parts from us for $1,000 and save $4,000 on parts. You're doing great. Times how many cars you're doing a week, times a month, times a year. It made sense to use us. So then we would get orders for cars, and we got a little extra if it was the same color. Because then they don't have to. You don't have to send it through the paint shop, which was good. So you know, we were then, in the beginning, we dumped the cars, the skeletons, and we'd even take them apart in Casino Park, Cunningham Park. We would literally strip the cars there. And then at some point or another, one of the body shop guys says, I'm going to get you a warehouse. And back then, before 9/11, I flew to go do heists under phony names. You just booked an airline ticket, so it was easy to even lease a place under a phony name. Now you need ID. You got to do this. Right. You got to do that. You know, they have to verify who you are. It's a different world now. But back then, they just leased a place under a phony name. And then, you know, we left all the skeletons when we were done and just ditched it. So that we would do that. And we tagged them now and then too. I drove tag jobs. That was your thing. Yeah. So I'll tell you what we did. And this will bring back memories for you then, Vic. We weren't really like sophisticated tag jobbers, just so you know. The GM, they had GM rivets. You know, you took out the windshield.
Rosettes.
Exactly. That's exactly
right. Okay. So you're talking about the VINs.
You had the VIN number in the windshield, in the dashboard, the front of the dashboard, usually on the left side, right where the Reggie is. And we took the windshield out, or popped the dashboard out. We you know, banged out the rivets, and then we would put the new rivets. We had the GM rivets. A friend of mine who was big in the car business got us the legitimate GM rivets, the rosettes, like he said. So we would glue them in, crazy glue them in, and put the thing back in, put the windshield back in. Now, if Vic pulled us over and he checked all of the other numbers on the car, we're dead. But we were counting on, just for the most part, if a regular beat cop, you know, regular.
Well, you didn't even change like the door label or.
Once in a while, that's the only other thing we did, is this driver's door. We once in a while did. No, nothing else on the car. Once in a while, just the driver's door, the left driver's door, exactly, right on the side.
Were you getting salvage cars and just take
it? No, we would do clean titles. The salvage was always – salvage was a mess because you had to go to motor vehicles.
Right, for an inspection.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then they bust your motor vehicle. So
you could wash the title by bouncing it into New Jersey.
We didn't know that. Like I said, we weren't the most sophisticated when it came to that. Yeah, I didn't know that one. So if I had known that, I'd have done it. So yeah, we would buy clean title, and it was, you just register it. It's done. Right. And if it's a different color, let's say I had my wrecked car was a black Eldorado, and then I stole a champagne Baritz. Right. So I would then just change that motor vehicle, change that, and say I painted it and change it from black to champagne, but it was a clean title. So nobody's inspected it. No one cares.
Did you try to keep the same year? Because a lot of times with guys get greedy, and they would go sometimes the color, but other times they'd go 3-4 years ahead. And we'd look, and I'm like, there is no way that's a 95. You know what I mean?
I'm going to make you laugh. You just nailed it. Yeah. So we always tried to do the same year. And one day I got greedy, and I did, it was like a 79 tag, 79 rec. With like, I think by time 82, 83, it was the same style. And whatever it was, whatever the years were, you might remember this better than I would. I pulled into a lot. I was going to sell the car. And we did this once in a while where we pulled into used car lots. Sometimes they knew, sometimes they didn't. And I pulled into the used car lot, and I go, I asked for a lot less. I wanted quick cash. And the guy lifted the hood, and he goes, it doesn't make sense. This is the 4100 engine,
right?
The 4100 or whatever. So it was a different engine. Everything else about the body style was identical. And I said, oh, sorry. And I closed the thing and pulled out. I closed the hood and pulled out of there. So
the kids used to do that all the time with the BMWs. They would steal, they would have a salvage, or they would get a 3 Series bin kit, and then they'd put it on a stolen M3. And you see that thing go by, and it's like, that's not a kit he's got on there. And then we pull him over, and the next thing you know, he's in handcuffs. But yeah, that was my specialty tag job.
You sniff, You sniffed them out on the street, a lot of these then, I'm sure, right?
Hundreds.
Yeah.
Well, when I started out, this is in 1995, stolen cars, there was a chase every night. Not some nights, but every night. And the way you could tell, well, first off, if somebody just took off when they saw you in a marked squad, they're like, oh, shit, odds are it's a stolen car. But back then, GMs were super easy to steal because you'd peel the column and just use a screwdriver to, you know, engage.
The tilt wheel, you just break the tilt.
Yeah. And a lot of times that screwed up the rear lights.
Right.
You know, it would screw up the electrical and, you know, if the brake lights didn't work, the blinkers didn't work. It's like, okay. Or if there's like no license plate or license plates hanging by one, like not because they were in a hurry. And it's like all these things, it's like, you know, so if you're a writer and you're listening, these are clues. Plus there's also
a bandana wrapped around the steering column.
Yes.
Or a bandana. Remember this, the tag jobs. Yeah. You'll have like a blue interior with a red steering column.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know if you remember the foreign cars with just a slap hammer. A lot of the Japanese cars were just, we use a dent puller.
Yeah, easy.
The slap hammer, dent puller, pop it right out, screwdriver, you're out of there.
Yeah. Well, we had a problem with bump keys for Toyotas and Hondas. It was a shave down key, and if you just slammed it in hard enough, it would start it. You know, you could get them on freaking could get them on Amazon. I mean,
So that's more recent then. I'm going back in the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, so this is more recent. And we had a chief that did away with car chases. And so, of course, the stolen car market just exploded. You know, it's like cops can't chase us. So, of course, we're going to steal a whole lot more cars and do more crimes. Right. And I'm in all these meetings. I was a sergeant. I was a boss. And it's like, well, we need to think of fresh new ideas to get these car thieves. I said, chase them and arrest them. Hello. Well, we can't say that in front of the chief. We can't do that. And I'm like, so, you know, I've got a lieutenant sitting next to me and he says, hey, we did a search warrant yesterday on a house where we think these guys are stealing cars and we found a bump key. And I said, that's all you got out of a search warrant? One freaking bump key? Said, did you arrest him? And he's like, well, no, it's not illegal to have one of those. It's illegal if you're using it, but it ain't illegal to have one, you know. And I just, it was like popping a balloon, you know. He was all excited and happy. And I'm like, well, was the car in his basement? You know, these people are just, it's so ridiculous. Yeah. And then, like, modern, we had Audis getting stolen because the shitheads found out that in the owner's manual, there's a plastic key. So you break the glass. High-end
cars, BMW, Mercedes. It's a valet key that comes in that book. So you know, you're like with the newer cars. It's like an Encyclopedia Britannica that's in the glove box that nobody looks at. Yeah, there's those keys in there.
Yeah,
so that's after my time.
Yeah, so a bunch of Audis that are just picking the bones clean from there, and Kias for some reason. We even had a gang called the Kia Boys. That's all they did was steal Kias because they were so easy to steal. They made a video on YouTube. This is how stupid they are. They made a rap video on YouTube.
I hope you guys got them on that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're all in
jail, just the stupidity.
Oh, my God. And then, you know, it's some white kid from the suburbs that's making this video, and he got arrested.
Yeah.
For being like, he's like, I don't understand. And it's like, you're an oxygen thief. That's what you are. You're just dumb. Yeah. You know, it's just, oh, my God. So, you know, you're doing these chop jobs, then I guess graduated up to hijackings, you know, like.
Yeah, the hijacking stemmed from the cars, believe it or not. I was in an auto body shop one day, and there's a huge, you know, the old Snap-on toolboxes.
Oh, yeah.
It might have been Macco. Yeah, and this thing's huge, and it's like the size of a dress. And I said, wow, you know, what's this thing go for? And he said, something of a few thousand dollars these things go for. And then he told me.
Big money.
Yeah, and so the truck comes once a week, every other day. Yep. Sometimes it depends. And I said, "What's the truck worth?" He goes, "They probably got $100,000 on there." So I said, "You kidding me? You want one?" So that's sort of how the high. Yeah,
the light went off.
Yeah, light bulb went off, and then I realized that in all of my stupidity and ignorance, I was smart enough to realize that, gee, I have to steal X amount of cars, as opposed to this one truck. You know, if I could get X amount of dollars for this truck, I could do this one truck. And then I realized that there's all these other trucks that are just as easy to take. And some of them have loads that are worth a lot more. And that's sort of then I veered off into, and I wish, because the hijacking was ended up, heist and hijackings is what I ended up doing for years then after that. And that's what got me in, you know, a heap with the feds. And had I stuck with the cause, eventually you and Vic would have arrested me. I probably would have did 2 or 3 years, maybe
if
four.
That, if that probation where I was at, yeah. On your 10th or 11th, maybe you'll get like a month.
Yeah. it would have been, if I was smart enough to realize like rewards and, you know, risks versus reward, right. I probably would have been smart enough to say, why don't I stick with the cause and never pick up a gun, you know, and never, it would have been a different world. And I would have been in and out, like you said. Yeah. But then again, too, you know, look, we all have a path in life, right?
So absolutely.
I regret the things I did, but whatever it was, I probably couldn't have averted it.
Yeah. So, you know, you really ramp things up because, you know, stealing cars for the most part is kind of a safe thing. You know, you're not doing it when the person is there unless you're hijacking somebody, carjacking somebody.
No, but we would never carjack. That was an innocent person. So it was like, yeah, it wasn't like goods is like, I mean, not that the driver of a truck isn't innocent.
Right.
It felt horrible. But I felt like there's a difference back then I felt between a domestic where you're taking a mother and father or a grandmother out of a car, as opposed to we just want your truck. We promise we're not going to hurt you. You know, we just want the load. And we felt like then in my own sick mind, I felt like we were sort of like Robin Hood-esque where we were like, you know, we're stealing from corporations that could afford to lose a load. Whereas I don't want to steal somebody's car. You know, I love everybody in my neighborhood. I love all my neighbors. I love my friends and family. It's right. I felt like then that would be like beneath me to do something like that. But looking back, not to say what I did was any better. You know, you're taking a truck driver, he's shitting in his pants too. But we would tell him, by the way, we don't want to hurt you.
I mean, nothing made my blood boil more than a carjacking where you have like some woman in the alley parking her car, you know, she's got an armful of groceries, some shitheads come along, knock her down, she's pregnant, and they have to kick her in the stomach a few times. It just makes you want to just catch those guys badly.
Pat, I got to tell you, Pat, if I witnessed a carjacking, I'd have been the guy, I'm not calling the police, I'm coming after you myself. So that's how much I was against something like that.
Yeah, that's just, you know,
I was in front of, when I was a kid, I mentioned it in my memoir. I still have it somewhere in my papers. A bank president gave me a commendation because he was looking through the window when one of his patrons or customers, rather, an old woman walked out of a bank. Me and my friend, we were kids at the time. We're in a stolen car. Give you an idea how twisted our minds was. We're in a stolen car and I'm watching this old lady walk on the sidewalk and some kid swipes at her with a razor. And he grabs her bag. He said later, I was only trying to cut the bag strap if they hold it. So, but he's, all I see is a swipe and he grabs a pocketbook and takes off. So in my mind, he swiped at an old lady with a knife. That son of a bitch. I jumped out of a stolen car, tackled him to the ground, disarmed him and held him until the bank president came out, called the cops, 109th precinct came, locked the kid up. And I got back in the stolen car and drove away. He goes, what's your name? He goes, what's your name? I gave him my name before I got back in the car and drove away. I gave him my, you know, obviously my friend's in the car. So it's not like he's going to, he don't know it's stolen. So I give him my name and he writes this beautiful commendation to my house that I still have today. So that's sort of like my mind. And some people will go, oh, you know, in the mob, you know, if the mob guys knew that I did that, they would say, oh, you're not supposed to, it's an old lady. You swipe at an old lady with a knife. I don't give a shit what you're about. Yeah. You're going down. You know, so that's all I saw. But in my twisted mind, like I said, I'm committing a crime over here. You know, I'm getting back into a stolen car and driving away. So, you know, it's like, but it gives you the sense of how twisted your values are at that point. You know, I love my family and friends. I wouldn't want anybody to see carjacked, but I'd hijack. So,
There's certain things, you know, I was born on the south side of Chicago. You know, all my family's from Ireland. And my grandma on St. Patrick, like a couple of days before St. Patrick's Day, is going to the dime store to get St. Patrick's Day cards. She's 80 years old, 4'10", and some asshole is taking her purse on the street, broad daylight, knocks her down, breaks her arm. And there was a couple of citizens that saw it, and ordinarily you'd say, well, those are kind of some shady characters. They chased the guy down and held him down till the cops got there. Luckily, there was a beat man there. And this is Chicago a while ago. And it's like, so they call an ambulance. He says, I'm not hurt. And he said, you're going to be. So they broke both of his arms and his jaw. Yeah. And there was a preliminary hearing. Finish the story. There's a prelim hearing. And they wheel the guy in, the defendant, in a wheelchair. And he's got both arms in casts. And his jaw is wired closed. And the judge is just looking. My dad's with my grandma. And my grandma, you know, again, 80 years old, wearing a babushka, you know, arm in a cast. You know, she had to have surgery for where it was broken. And they're leaving. And they're still in the courtroom. And my grandma's trying to give the cops $100 bills. It's like, oh, thank you so much. Like, no, we can't do that in here. No, Mrs. McKay, please don't do that in here. Yeah. Here, for your troubles. Yeah, real thick Irish accent. I'm like, oh, my God. No, grandma.
I think that's when cops and criminals, for the most part, are on the same page. You see a little old lady get tossed to the ground. You know, I mean, that's it. You know, for the most part, most criminals, not all.
All bets are off. Yes. No doubt about it.
Yeah.
So you're doing hijackings. That really ramps stuff up. Did you ever think that you're going to get shot or hurt or even arrested?
We were brazen. I'm going to tell you something. The first truck I hijacked, and we had somebody throw shots at us once when we were robbing cars, by the way. It was an off-duty cop.
Oh, but, wow.
You know, hopefully he was aiming over our heads, although we were short. Hopefully he was aiming over our heads. But, whatever the case was, when I hijacked my very first truck, I hijacked. This is a true story. The guy says to me, he goes, you guys are really, me and my friends were on the truck. He goes, you guys are nice kids. You're not, because we told him, look, we only want the truck. We'll never hurt you. We put a pillow under his head. We said, do you need anything from the truck? He says, yeah, give me the pictures of my family. Put them in my pocket, please. Give me that clipboard. I need it. Just stick it under my arm because so I could make it the insurance thing a lot easier for me later. It's got the manifests or whatever, the sheet. So at some point he goes, you guys are really nice kids. He goes, you ever think this is going to catch up with you? I didn't think about that until I was in the penitentiary. That's when it came back to me. I went right over my head. It had to catch up to me. I just started, you know, like, how would you even think about that? So no, I never thought about, I look back and I say, thank God, not only did we never get shot, but thank God we never had to shoot anybody.
Right.
Because the guilt would have killed me. I had enough guilt at one point when I started to reevaluate my life. I had enough guilt just from the things I did, let alone if somebody had accidentally been killed. I mean, I would have probably just murdered myself because I was on the verge of suicide just thinking about all the shit I did. So I don't think I could have lived with that guilt. And I thank God, looking back, you know, even if you're stealing a car, you could accidentally kill somebody, an innocent pedestrian, because you're racing through, you know, through streets. I'm going to tell you something that nearly broke my heart, and I almost had to live with this guilt, and I thank God I didn't. There was a guy named Mike, and he was from the like sort of Middle Village, Maspeth area. He used to steal cars for me, and I had a Lincoln LSC. You remember those cars with the Bill Blass rag top?
And he said, yeah.
Yeah. So he goes, Lou, it was a two-door, the Lincoln LSC. They made them for a few years. He goes, Lou, I could steal you the skirt. I'll get you the skirt kit and the rims for this. I said, sure, I'd love it. So then one night he's stealing cars, and apparently he was being chased by a cop. And he ends up, he was with a guy and two girls that were in the stolen car with him. So he might have picked up the girls after while he was using his stolen car. But he's with a guy and two girls. And as he's being chased, he gets enough distance between him and the cops. And he tells them, get out. So he get everybody else out of the car. Thank God. He was a nice kid, I got to tell you, rest his soul. And a couple of miles later, he gunned it. A couple of miles later, the cops are on his ass again. And what happened was, down by that sort of like Grand Avenue section, there was a garbage truck that saw the cops chasing him. And the garbage guy figured, you know, look, let me help the cops. And he pulled the garbage truck out into the intersection. And the car went straight under it. And he was dead. So when I heard that he died in an LSC, I'm going to tell you, my heart was torn out of my chest. I was a mess. And when I got down to where the car was, I had to go see the car. And when I got down to the car, one of the greatest reliefs in my life, in my entire lifetime, was the moment I saw the car, which, by the way, had no drivers, completely crushed from the top. And the hood was against the, you know, there was no place for your legs in the driver's section. You know, just imagine, it was just, you know, he was crushed, like in a crusher. But by the grace of God, I saw that it did not have rims and it did not have a skirt kit. And I said, thank God it wasn't the car that he was stealing from me. Yeah, and yeah. I would have lived with that guilt the rest of my life. I would have been tormented the rest of my life. And I thanked God, by the grace of God, this car had nothing to do with me. I didn't give him an order for that car. It didn't have the skirt kit or the rims, which means it wasn't the one he was getting for me. And I was just relieved and still tormented over his death. But so just to go back to what you were saying, had I been responsible for somebody's death, it would have killed me for the rest of my life. And I thank God that didn't happen.
So you're leveling up, you're making some money. Is that when organized crime kind of took notice of you? It's like, hey, this guy is.
Yeah, eventually, if you're making money on the street, it's almost like if you open up, let's say you're in Chicago, right?
Yeah.
And you go, here's a real high traffic area. I'm going to open up a cell phone store. And you open up a cell phone store on the corner and you're making money hand over fist. Everybody needs a new cell phone. And you got traffic coming in and out. How long do you think you're going to go before the IRS comes in and says, do you pay your taxes? You know, right. just curious. Have you filed your taxes? No, but well, how'd you know I was here? We'll find you. You know, they're going to find you.
Yeah, they will.
So if you're making money on the street and word gets around and you're hijacking trucks, guys hear about it. And, you know, also too, I'm dealing with a lot of different guys because they got to sell the loads. So I'm meeting this guy. I'm meeting Vic. I'm meeting Pat. I'm meeting Joey. Okay. Vinny. You know, so I'm meeting different guys to sell my loads. And then you're meeting some guys who are on the fringe. You're meeting some guys who are real. You're meeting some guys who bullshit a lot. You're meeting some guys who they tell you, drop it off at 8 o'clock. Your money will be there. And it is. So you're starting to like figure out who's real, who's not, who I'm going to make money with, who I'm not. It's a big, long process where it doesn't just happen. You know, I could never go back. Let's say I wanted to go back to the streets tomorrow. Just to relearn whatever the frig is going on would take me too much time. You know, probably take me the rest of my life. It's a process you got to be involved in. It's a lifestyle that comes with it, morning, noon, and night. Your life becomes a crime in progress, and every waking minute is meeting somebody, talking to somebody, doing something. You can't do that part-time, and you can't do it on a fast track. It's something that has to happen naturally. It evolves by itself, and that's how it happened.
Okay, so a typical day, now you're in – the mafia. Mm-hmm. What's like a typical day in the mob? Did you talk typical in code or what?
Yeah, you talk to guys. You know, I didn't like talking, so they had never had tapes on me. I had three indictments. Yeah, I was indicted by the Secret Service. I was indicted by the FBI, and I was indicted by Nassau County Organized Crime Task Force. Out of the three indictments, there was never a single tape on me because I was anal about talking on the phone. If somebody called me and talked on the phone, I hung up. If I was even in a car, I didn't even want to talk in a car. Yeah, I was totally, and then I was the first guy to go away of everybody. I said, all you guys haven't stopped bullshitting, and I'm the first guy who goes away. I used to tell them that on the visits. I go, you guys are talking all over the place, and they get me. So I would even be in a car. Let's say me, you, and Vic are traveling in a car, and we stop. And let's say you, Pat, you stop bullshitting about, you know, that thing we did last week. We grabbed that truckload or whatever. I would say, pull over. Pull over. We're on the Van Wyck Expressway, let's say. Pull over. I don't even care if it's expressway. Pull onto the shoulder. We'd get off on the shoulder and we'd get out of the car and we'd talk. And then when we were done, I'd say, look, come on. Don't talk in the car. We don't know whose car's a bug. So sure. I was anal like that. And then we get back in the car. So we were like, I was mostly careful and I was ended up getting, like I said, I went down first, which was interesting because I was a little wild. I did a lot of things too. But I was really, really careful. And my friend used to bust my chops about that. He says, you're nuts. You think they care about us? Come on. You know, meanwhile, they're looking for big guys like John Gotti. They don't care about us. But you know what? I learned when I had all those indictments that they do care about all of us.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Look. Yeah. You guys
want to go up.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Exactly. Now, did you hold like a legitimate job just for like IRS purposes?
No, I never, till the day I went to prison, I never worked a job in my life. And to this day, I came home from jail and I became a writer and I would be writing all day. And then I talked to my father and he goes, why don't you get a job? I go, Dad, I got a job. I haven't left my desk though. I've been at my desk for 12 hours. That's not a real job. Go work a real job. So, I never punched a clock my whole life, but I've worked, I busted my ass since I came home from jail in every other way, but I never had a job back then. I was one of the guys, some guys did have a job. I was with guys, the core guys in my crew didn't work. They were like me. This was their full-time job. Now, there were guys, believe it or not, I had a guy who was great at heists, one of the best guys you could ever bring. And this goes to show you, this is a good, this is a good question for psychologists. What goes into this sort of like the nature of this type of person? And I think it's just survival. That's what I think. But if we had, let's say he's working, he was a carpenter. Let's say he's working and he's got work and he's, and they're feeding him work and he's framing houses and everything's good. And he's only making a few hundred dollars a week, let's say back then, which was a lot of money, right? And I went to him and I say, I got $1 million heist. He would go, I'll pass. I need you. I tell you, come on. Lou, I'm good. I'm working. Thanks. You pass on $1 million heist? Absolutely. I don't need it. I'm happy working. Now, if he was out of work and his bills weren't paid, he was the first one banging on the door going, what do you got? And I told him I got something for 10 grand. He'd go, I'll do it. So I'm going, you son of a bitch. You didn't want the $1 million heist when you're working. Now you're gonna stick somebody up for 10,000? Yeah, why not? I need money. So this is a guy who's really not a hardened criminal. You know, this is where we could talk about, like, if the economy ever really tanks in this country and we go back to the Depression era, what this country is going to look like, because a lot of people who wouldn't normally commit crimes are going to be out there committing crimes.
Yes.
I promise you. And that, yeah. And that's an example of that. Yeah.
Yes. So, you know, you often hear, let me go back a little bit. So eventually you got arrested. What were the circumstances and which agency or agencies gotcha?
So the first thing that happens was I got subpoenaed, and I tip my hat to the feds, the FBI agents. They did a great job with me. They tore apart my life, and they really made me feel like I was public enemy number one. And when I eventually went to jail, from the biggest bosses and underbosses to the smallest guys like me, I realized that they made every one of us feel like public enemy number one. And I got to tip my hat to you guys as law enforcement officers. To make people feel like that is, you know, you're doing your job right. If you make people feel, and I think Vic said it a minute ago, that's how we go up. You know, you put all the pressure on the little guy, he gives up the next.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You make your way up. So the first thing was they came to my house with a subpoena and they subpoenaed me, the feds. So I looked out my window and I saw trench coats on my porch. Ugh. So I said, son of a bitch, it's, you know, it's gotta be feds. You know, you just normally cops were dressed down, you know, So I said, it's got to be the Fed. So I called my friend. I told him, pick me up around the block. And I did the backyards. And I went to, I'm going to tell you how on top of things, though, the feds were. I went to a friend of mine's store, which was one of my haunts. And I get into the store. I go in there and I'm in the back and I'm talking to them. And I'm going, the feds were just at my house. How do you know they were feds? I don't know. They dressed like feds. They were stiff looking. They had trench coats on. I looked out the window. I saw it. So he says, so somebody yells in the back. He goes, Lou, the feds are out front. You think it's for you? It was for me again. They came right to where I hang out.
They're on your phone.
So they knew. They were going, yeah, yeah. That, or they knew my haunt, so they were going to go one at a time.
Yeah,
or the phone.
They're surveilling
so
you.
So whatever the case was, now I got, yeah. So eventually I get a subpoena, and I'm going to tell you what happened with this subpoena. This is interesting. We had a guy, my friend's uncle. Now, the mob guys, I dealt with the mob, obviously, and all the families. But I never, believe it or not, I didn't fence my trucks to a mob guy because they always try to get you. They're chomping on a cigar and they know you want your button. So they try to get your figure. And I got the guy by the balls.
Right.
You know, I owe maybe $100,000 for this load, but he wants his button. I'm going to offer him $20. But do me a favor, Louie. You know, Louie, you know me. I'll always look out for you. You know, it's always the same bullshit with these guys. So I'd rather just sell it to my own guy and then kick up to who I got to kick up to. So you're still appeasing the guys you got to appease. You know, you're still in with the guys in your family. You're still putting it on record. You're still paying people. People are making money, but nobody's taking me for a ride. So I used to go to my friend's uncle, and my friend's uncle, another friend of mine, had an uncle who was from the city, 47th Street, Manhattan. He lived in Times Square, but he was a hustler on 47th Street. I'm going to give you a little insight. This guy was one of the biggest fences you could ever meet. Like if you went to him and said, I have the crown jewels taken right out of the Tower of London. Most people would go, what the frick you want me to do with those? I get busted in 3 minutes. He would take them. He knew what to do with them. He knew how to get rid of them. He'd been down there for 40, 50 years. He knew that street inside and out. And that was the biggest concentration of gold and diamonds in probably the world, 47th Street Jewelry District. So we would go to him and he took any load. He was a fence. And it didn't matter, just not just jewelry, not just diamond stuff. He just happened to be from that area, but it could be a load of anything. Could be a load of American flags. And he'll tell you, I know where to sell them. There's a MAGA rally coming up. We're going to get rid of them. We're going to unload them at the MAGA rally. So whatever the case was, you know, there was no MAGA then, but whatever the case was, you understand. So he knew how to get rid of everything. So this guy, he, one day when we get subpoenaed, I get subpoenaed, then my friend gets subpoenaed, another guy gets subpoenaed, and we're trying to figure out what's going on. Then he gets subpoenaed, defense. So we're on our way to the city to go bullshit with him one night. We're going to talk about the subpoena. And what the Fed did was when our lawyers called up, my lawyer specifically called up and said, what are the things you're looking into? What's the subpoena for? And they listed off a series of different crimes that they were investigating me and my friends for. So we're on our way to the city to talk to him. I called him. His name was, I could say his name. I think he's got to be gone now. He was in his 60s then. So he'd be like, you know, close to 100 now. Yeah. But called him in my memoir, Uncle Jimmy. His real name was Uncle Billy. So we called him up. I says, we're on our way into the city. And before we get to the city, we got off by, I don't know if you remember, there was like the Mass Pit exit over Fresh Pond Road. We got off over there, and there used to be this eatery called Bettino's.
Oh, yeah.
It was there for a while. You remember it, Vic? Yeah. So we went there. I says, go to Bettino's. We'll grab a bite to eat before we go into the city because we're going to be with your uncle all night. And so we go over there. We're grabbing a bite, and I'm going over in my head the things the feds want to question us about. And at some point I realized we had told them a little while back, we wanted to keep them honest. So we told them, look, we got a load of whatever it was, but we didn't have it. And then we were going to tell them, the plan was to tell them we had a load of XYZ, and then we got rid of it before we ended up unloading it to somebody else. We dumped it elsewhere so that he knows we could go elsewhere with our loads. We don't need him. So we're going to make up a load, tell him we got it. And then a few days later, we're going to tell him we dumped it elsewhere just to keep him honest. Well, it turns out he was always honest with us. It turns out we had no reason to fear that he was cheating us. He wasn't. But we did this. We did this because we thought in our head that he lowballed us on a couple of the last loads, and we wanted to keep him honest. So whatever the case was, we never hijacked this one particular truck. So when we go through the different things that the feds got that we really did do, and this one thing is jumping out, I said, son of a bitch, we never robbed that truck. He says, what do you mean? I go to your uncle. I told your uncle to keep him honest. He goes, yeah. I says, if the feds know about this and it never happened, it can only come from your uncle. Your uncle's the rat.
Yeah.
So he goes, no, my uncle's no. I says, I'm telling you, says, son of a bitch, you're right. So I says, call him up, and I bet you he's going to get all bent out of shape that we're not coming. He must be sitting in the room wired. They probably got cameras all over the room. We're going to talk about everything we ever did with him, and they're going to come out from behind the door and arrest us. So he goes, yeah. So we called up, and he was bent out of shape. When are you coming? What do you mean you're not coming? Why aren't you coming? We need to talk. So I said, wow, he's a rat. So that sort of like sparked the whole thing. So now I got the FBI on me. And then at some point I get arrested by the Secret Service. And the Secret Service case was interesting because I go, I never threatened the president. I didn't know what the Secret Service did. You know, and then I'm thinking maybe on the phone when I'm in a tirade cursing everybody. This son of a bitch and bastard, that other bastard, this, maybe I did curse the president. Who knows? I don't know. So and they picked it up. I'm trying to figure out why the Secret Service is surrounding my house with machine guns. What the frig is going on, right? So it turns out that I was involved in a thing where these guys was opening up companies, and they would open up a fake company, get approved to accept credit cards, run 40, 50,000 through or whatever it was, and then close up and walk away. Draw the money out, and they were defrauding the credit card companies by making phony sales, phony purchases through shell companies. So that's how I understood it at the time, because I wasn't necessarily involved directly with that. So that's how I understood it. But at some point they started screwing each other, and one of the guys involved came to me as sort of like the mob guy who was going to get his money. So I told him, because I had a name on the street, that I was with the Gambino family. People knew who I was. I said, you tell him, come up with the money, pay it or else. You know, that's sort of like, that's usually all I had to do to get paid. Yeah. So I told him that. And then the guy told him to go F himself, that he had somebody behind him. And then it kept escalating. And at some point or another, that case came to haunt me. So I had really nothing to do with the actual credit cards, with the defrauding, I had nothing to do with that. But
your name got thrown up in the mix.
I got thrown up in the mix. And because I was the big guy, that, you know, he's the mob guy. They made me the quote unquote hub of the conspiracy. And I go, how the frick am I a hub of a conspiracy? I didn't even know how they're doing it. Like, I learned in court how these guys were doing it for the first time. You know, like, that's like the first time it was explained to me how deep this thing was. And I'm like, dang, wow, these guys are so stupid, huh? That was pretty intricate, you know? So whatever the case was, that was another case on my, so I got the Fed case coming down, which they didn't indict me on yet, but they're up my ass. Then I got the Secret Service case. Then I'm coming home one night and I pull into my driveway. The doors swing open on the left and right. Nassau County police cops, guns to my head. Freeze, MFA. Move and we'll kill you. I said, son of a bitch. I could have ducked. They would have shot each other. So they arrest me. They know what they're doing, but they arrest me. And I said, what's this for? So there was apparently a stick up that one of my co-defendants in the feds, he ended up being a co-defendant of mine in the feds. He had committed this and they arrested me for that. I never did that. But I'm stuck with the charge now. I'm not going to rat and say, this other guy did it. I'm stuck. Okay. I know I did a million other things. So that's, you know, I got to eat shit once in a while, right? So now I got the Secret Service case. I got the Nassau County organized crime case. And I eventually go to jail for the Secret Service case, which is 5 years. While I'm sitting in jail for the Secret Service case on the nickel and the state case for the stick up is still hanging over my head, the feds come and get me. And then the feds indicted me on a Hobbs Act, which was like a RICO, interstate commerce. And that was all the heists and hijackings. And they charged us with armored cars. They charged us with hijackings. They charged us with, I think there was a tool truck on there, you know, so I never stopped doing tool trucks, by the way. They were really easy. So, you know, there was everything on that. So, sure. So that's sort of like, so now I got three indictments I'm fighting at the same time. And they were offering us life, me and my co-defendants. We faced life. Because people go, how did you face life? No way, you didn't face life. You didn't kill anybody. Oh, yeah, you do. In the feds, you face life. And I got plenty of friends who were serving life for, 179 years, 138 years. That's right. Life. You know, it's not the word life, but if you have 10 counts, for example, and each count carries a 10-year statute, that's 100 years. Now, each time a gun is used in the commission of a crime, that's a nickel apiece for each count. So now that's 150 years. Now you say, well, will the government give you the 150? If you have the audacity
to take it to trial, challenge the
government and take it to trial, right? Exactly. And tie up a United States courtroom for the next 3 months.
That judge is going to hammer you.
Exactly. And they send messages back to the detention centers because when you got, you know, I can't tell you how many of my friends had cases identical to mine and they came back from sentencing and cried on my shoulder. Cried. I just got 110 years. I can't believe it. And they're still away now, 35 years later. So, you know, this happens. So just to be clear, it happens every day, 30 years later. So that said, I'm facing life. And at some point, they're offering us 20 years, take it or leave it, me and my co-defendants. And we didn't want, we kept fighting and fighting and fighting. I had William Kunstler. I don't know if you guys remember William Kunstler.
Oh, yeah, sure. How'd you get him?
It's an interesting story. So originally I had Barry Slotnick. And then
another
Slotnick
good heavyweight.
Yeah, so I had Barry Slotnick. Slotnick came off the case because he had a conflict. And then I ended up with Kunstler. When I went to visit Kunstler, he said, any friend of John Gotti's is a friend of mine. I'm taking your case. So that's kind of like what helped. And so Kunstler ends up taking on my case. And I got to tell you, I liked William Kunstler. He died while he was representing me, but I did like him as a person. He was a nut job. You know, I have different views of things he did now because I'm older and I understand things that he did that I wouldn't agree with. But back then, as far as it's a person, he was definitely a good guy, a good attorney. And he represented me. So I'm facing the 20 years. And at some point they came down and we didn't know this, but they offered me 13 years. And then my co-defendants, there were eight of us all stood up 10, 9, 8, 7, 6 down the line. If everybody takes a global plea, we'll give you guys these sentences. So my co-defendant said, Lou, do me a favor, take the 13. We could get the cheaper sentences. Let's get the hell out of this. Everybody's getting hundreds over here of years. Sure. I go, let's do it. Yeah. So I took the 13. I think it was 12 and a half to be exact. I took that and they ended up taking theirs. And then I learned when I reversed one of my cases on a technicality from prison that they had lost before we even took those pleas. There was a rat who was in the witness protection program. And I learned that when I went back to court that he had violated the program and they threw him out. before we even took those pleas. So we didn't even have to take, they didn't have the main snitch.
Right.
So I was like, oh, wow, son of a bitch. But I got to tell you, looking back, I would have never changed my life. I needed that. God works in mysterious ways. And, you know, he brought me through the iron furnace to change me. And I think it was necessary. So it's the best thing that I didn't know. And I went away all that time. Because by the time I reversed my case, I had 6.5 years in. I had changed my life around. You know, I was a different person. So had I never had that time, had we, let's say they dismissed the case before we got out by some crazy thing, or I just served a nickel for the Secret Service case, which would have been 4 years on, you know, with 85%, you got to do. I probably would have came back and went back to the same crap. I needed that big, big bang in the head to change my life. So it was all for the best.
Did they offer you anything like to be a rat and say, like, hey, you know what, if you give us this.
Yeah, they begged me. A lot of people go, oh, I'm glad Vic pointed out. They work your way up. A lot of people go, yeah. Oh, he was never a boss, an underboss, or a capo. Oh, they wouldn't need him as a rat. How the hell do you think they get the capos?
Exactly.
How do you think they get the capos then to get the capos to go bad, to get the underboss, to get the underboss to go bad, to get the boss? They work. They start with me, and they work their way up. They tortured me for that. That was what the three cases were about. You know, they keep putting pressure on you. You got three indictments. You're saying to yourself, who the frig am I to have three indictments?
Well, that, and you know, and you knew multiple families. So you would have been invaluable because you could have connected a lot of dots to a lot of families right. with a lot of things.
Yep. What did they offer you? Did they offer you witness protection?
Well, so at one point, my lawyers kept saying, the feds want to talk. And then at some point, they said they could even make a deal with you. If you just go in the room, nobody will know the information came from you. So they were even willing to allow me to talk like dry snitch. And I said, I'll know. There's, you know, I just something right. I can't do. And so what Vic said too about how they thought, you know, they realized how you could get bigger people. I'm in and out of Pete Gotti's house every single day of the week. So Pete Gotti, I'm close with Pete's son, Pete. So there's John Gotti had a son, Peter, and then Pete Gotti, John's oldest brother, who was a captain, eventually the boss, he had a son, Peter. So I'm in and out of his house every day. So they got my phone records going back and forth to Pete's house every single day of the week. So they're going, okay. And, you know, obviously I see Pete there, right, all the time. So, okay, maybe he could give us to Pete Gotti. Even if he gives us the kid, it's news headlines, right? So we got that. Now, on top of that, I happen to have been, and this was completely personal, this has nothing to do with the mob. Chin Gigante, the guy who used to walk the streets in a bathrobe, Vincent Chin Gigante, the Genovese boss, the boss of the Genovese family. Chin Gigante is the boss at the time, and he's sort of on a level with John, even more powerful than John, had more clout, more money, been there longer. I'm in and out of Gigante's house every weekend because I became dear friends with Gigante's youngest daughter, Rita, who I love to this day. She's my friend for 35 years. So Rita's my dear friend. I'm spending weekends at Rita Gigante's house. So my phone records are going back and forth to the Gigante house.
Oh, they loved you.
Oh, yeah. And you don't have to, when you're connected to the Gigantes and the Gotti's, even if you, it doesn't, yeah, there's you're
no,
a dream.
There's no going any higher.
Right, right, exactly. And you know, and at that point too, a lot of people would, you know, if they just heard things, they might be willing to say, well, I heard this, or maybe I know that, or
especially the chin, he was so secretive.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, so I looked on paper, like probably like a real big catch, you know, sure. I'm a marlin, you know, you're pulling in a marlin, not realizing maybe I'm just a guppy, you know, but you think you got a marlin on the line. So, you know, some of the pressure that I think I would attribute that to, you know, also too, I did some big heists, to be completely honest. You know, I was suspected of doing a lot of big heists, and they definitely wanted that too. So on top of that, but look, I once again, I tip my hat to the guys who worked on my cases. They played fair. And I'm okay with that. The agents played fair. I would have held a grudge if people played dirty, you know, but they put me through hell. They turned up every rock in my life. They called up ex-girlfriends. They called up every friend I had. They checked every, but they never crossed the line, the FBI agents. And that's what would have bothered me. I think when FBI agents are dirty, it makes your stomach sick because you want to think of America as a better place than that. And the FBI agents who came after me, they didn't play dirty. They got me fair and square. They tortured me. They put me through hell and they indicted me fair and square. You know, so, you know, one time an agent called my father And my father, they said to my father, who was an older man, look, your son's going to do 20 years at least, maybe the rest of his life in jail. We want to come over and talk to you. My father said, I'd rather not have you come talk to me, please. I don't want to think about that or talk about it. I don't want to know about it. And the agent respected my father. Now, the agent could have went there knowing my father doesn't know anything about me because he didn't. My father knew. I wouldn't tell my father my crimes. My father knew nothing. My father's a legitimate guy. Worked his whole life. But they could have still rapped at the door. They could have broke his balls. You know, when the Secret Service arrested me, my father came out on the porch. He was in his boxer shorts. It was early in the morning. And the agent goes to get out of the car. And I said, watch what you say. I'm cuffed. I said, watch what you say to him, because it's my father. And the agent turned to me and he says, whoa, Lou. He goes, I would never disrespect your father. I'm going to let him know you're not being kidnapped or anything. And that hopefully with a bail package, you'll be home later today. And the Secret Service agent was respectful. I saw him walk up to the porch. He's talking to my father. My father looks like he's getting calmer by the second. So the guy knew how to de-escalate my father's blood pressure. And he comes back, gets in the car, and he says, your father knows what's going on. Don't worry about it. I gave him my card. And I said, fine, thank you. So how do you hate these guys? They're doing their job. I'm doing mine. I had no beef with them. And I think that's the sort of like a deciding factor. Later on, I was away with a lot of the Colombo guys. I was, like I told you, I was close with the Arenas. Those guys had a different gripe. You know, the supposedly the FBI agent was dirty, you know, working with the, he ended up being indicted for murders. You know, he's working with the rat who's killing everybody, Gregory Scarpa. They had a reason to despise the FBI. I didn't have that same reason. I didn't feel that same way. I felt like they played within the boundaries.
All right. Now, you often hear about, you know, there's a code of honor. And I think we brushed on that, you know, in the mafia. You know, like you don't hurt women, you don't hurt children, you know, that kind of thing. Is that real?
Definitely. I mean, but they break the rules more and more nowadays. So, you know, when I grew up, you never, ever, you know, you defend women. You never hurt a woman. And if you got to get a guy, you don't get him near his house. If you catch him and he's with his wife, that's not when you got to get him. The guy could owe you $1 million. If he's with his wife or his wife and kids, you got to let him pass. That's how I was taught by the old timers, and that's how I believed. Now, things changed. You know, Gas Pipe Caso ordered somebody to, when Fat Pete Kyoto went sour. Fat Pete Kyoto went sour, and Gas Pipe couldn't get to Fat Pete, so he ordered somebody to shoot his sister. I mean, come on, man. Yeah, so, you know, that's something sick. And then the guy later on, the guy who turned out to be a stand-up guy, you know, he's following orders. What's he going to do? Gas Pipe will kill him if you don't do it. Yeah. So that's what, you know, this is how the mob became a cesspool of crap. You know, I mean, now he's stuck doing it. And then years later, I'm in jail with the guy. And the guy's being offered a plea. And he wants to take the plea, but he wants to include that particular shooting in the plea so that they don't come back later and haunt them with it. So he sends word to Gas Pipe, who wasn't a rat yet. I was with the guy at the time. He sends word to Gas Pipe and he says, look, can you do me a favor? And I want to put this into my plea. Or it happened right before the guy was with me. He goes, I want to put this into my plea. And so I'm covered for it. And Gas Pipe sends word back. No, we're not supposed to touch women. You're not allowed to say it. So the guy says, all right. Takes 25 years. Goes on his merry way. Gas Pipe flips. Gas Pipe tells the feds everything, including he ordered the guy to shoot the sister. And now the guy's dragged back into court for that. So he says, son of a bitch, I could have included it. The guy who tells me I'm not allowed is the guy who rats me out for it. So, you know, like I'm observing all this.
Yeah.
And saying, what a snake pit I was in. I don't need this crap. I don't need to be part of this garbage, you know, where I got to listen to the guy who either tells me to shoot a woman, an innocent woman, or I got to listen to the guy who tells me to shoot my best friend. Or I got to listen to the guy who mislabels somebody a rat, which Gas Pipe did time and time again. Gas Pipe mislabeled everybody a rat, had the guy killed, and then Gas Pipe killed all those guys who weren't rats and then becomes a rat. I'm going, what is this crap? This is bullshit. You know, this is like, this isn't for me. So that's sort of like what contributed to me going, I'm done. If I ever get out of this place, I don't want nothing to do with this. These people, this is garbage. You know, and although you meet a few guys in there who think like I do, you know, if you think like I do, then get the hell out yourself too. You know, because how long are you going to think like I do and roll around with pigs in their shit?
Thank you, everyone, for listening to part one of my interview with former Gambino crime family boss and now best-selling author Lou Ferrante. And a big thank you to my co-host for today, former NYPD detective, now podcaster and author Vic Ferrari. If you want to see what happens next, you're going to have to come back next week for the exciting conclusion of this interview. Well, that wraps up another episode of the Cops and Writers Podcast. If you haven't done so yet, you take a minute and rate and review this show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. If you have already, thank you. As always, thank you for all of your support, and, of course, let's be careful out there.